Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is TWiG, This Week in Google, episode 53, recorded July 28, 2010. A World of Gibbons. This Week in Google is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated sync, featuring true hands-free calling, turn-by-turn directions, 911 assist, and more. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com. And be sure to listen for an update on innovations from Maker Faire at the Ford Museum in Detroit, featuring inventions from 300 makers, live on Saturday and all week next week. And by Carbonite. Backing up the files on your PC or Mac is safe and easy with Carbonite. For a free trial plus 2 free months with purchase, go to Carbonite.com, offer code TWIG. It's time for TWIG This Week in Google, covering the cloud, the Googleverse, and anything else we damn well want to talk about. Joining us right now, Mr. Kevin Purdy, who's filling in for Gina Trapani. I guess you could say that. Gina's on vacation. Kevin is at lifehacker.com and is the Android expert. In fact, your book is it out yet, or is it coming out soon?
No, it never out. It is coming soon. I would say the wiki will be out in about 30 days-ish, and I will have something to talk about later on the show, though.
Good. Yeah, a little special offer for those of you who listen. It will be just like Gina's Complete Guide to Google Wave. It'll be the Complete Guide to Google Android, basically, yes?
Yep, same publisher, same type of model, and hopefully the same kind of community interaction, too.
I'm excited about it. I'm a big Android, as people who listen to the show know, I'm a big Android fan. I've gone to the Droid X, and I just love it. What are you using right now, Nexus One, or...?
The Nexus, yes. Yeah. Mostly because to write the book, I wanted to make sure I had Android 2.2 as soon as it came out. So the Nexus, and which is a very nice phone, too.
Love the Nexus One. And you have the pure Google experience. Some news about the Nexus One we'll get to in just a little bit. Also here from his vacation in the Poconos, Jeff Jarvis. You cannot be in the Poconos.
No champagne-shaped tub for me. We are in the Poconos. I want to give a plug. I'm at Sky Top Lodge in the Poconos, which is a island of civility in the otherwise trailer park bit of Pennsylvania here. 4,000 acres, beautiful space. We've been coming here for 16 years. The kids absolutely love it. Lakes and pools and animals and all kinds of great stuff. So Sky Top Lodge. Twitter is Sky Top Lodge.
And this is kind of a special last trip with Jake, I guess, because he's off to college in the fall.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't want to make you cry
last
or anything.
Full family together.
Yeah.
Yeah, you too, Leo, huh?
Me too. We're driving, we're flying to Manhattan next week and driving up the Hudson River Valley to drop off Abby in New York State as well. So, and we're
all early.
Yeah. They start 3 weeks early for the freshmen there. They have a special... course in literature and writing, which I think is a really good idea. Glad to get Jay Rosen back on the show as well. Jay, it's nice to have you.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for asking me on.
Jay is a professor of journalism at NYU, and his blog, pressthink.org?
Yes, it is.
.org is a great place to go to find out about the new journalism. And he's busily, like Jeff, crafting new journalists. As we speak, he's modeling the clay.
Frankenstein-like.
Jeff, what is that room you were in there? It looks like a conference room or something at a Holiday Inn.
Yeah,
what is it?
They're giving you a conference room here. No. It's much nicer than that. It's a conference room with a direct connection. So the sales department's across the hall.
Ah, good.
Well, I should have mountains behind me and deer running by and lakes and things, but I don't.
We'll put that in with green screen later.
You look like you're at a Marriott at O'Hare.
I wasn't going to say anything, Jay, but it's true.
You should have put me in a room with a window. Yes, yeah, so you'd see that. You see the sylvan surroundings.
Oh, I'm just jealous. That's all. So one of the reasons I wanted to get Jay on this week is really not having much to do with Google, but it's certainly part of our purview to cover the internet. And because of Jeff, we talk a lot about journalism and how it's being impacted by the internet. And we have talked about WikiLeaks before on the show. WikiLeaks is very big in the news right now, and a little bit controversial in the news right now. Jeff, do you want to summarize what's going on? I mean, Jay, I'm sorry.
Sure. Sunday afternoon, the New York Times, The Guardian in the UK, and Der Spiegel in Germany went live with their respective reports on a trove of documents that WikiLeaks had received that are intelligence reports about the Afghanistan war. And it emerged very quickly that these three news organizations had been provided with access to the documents about a month earlier. They had all worked together and separately on their coverage and the stories they wrote about them. And then shortly after the stories went live on the internet, WikiLeaks released full text documents themselves on their site.
75,000.
Yes, and also announced that they had about 15,000 more that they haven't released yet that they are editing for reasons of safety, meaning they don't want to do harm to possible intelligence sources and other people who might come into danger as a result of what they're doing. So you had, first of all, this story of here's what the documents say about the war in Afghanistan. You had the collaboration among the three news organizations. And then you had this massive leak that WikiLeaks had received a while ago, resulting in publication of tens of thousands of intelligence reports marked not top secret, but secret, which is the second highest classification in United States intelligence services. And since then, there's been reaction on several fronts. There's been, first of all, what the documents say about the war and how difficult it is to win. There's been this discovery by many people who didn't know much about it of WikiLeaks as a what I call the world's first stateless news organization, which we can get into more later. And then, of course, there's the story of new media and old media collaborating or at least cooperating in the release of the story, which is also fascinating to people like Jeff and myself. And then there's the usual controversy over whether the leak harms national security and the denunciations from the White House in the name of national security, which we've pretty much come to expect whenever something like this happens. So that's what's been going on. And the buzz really hasn't stopped since Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. Is this the Pentagon Papers for the 21st century?
Well, it's kind of annoying because people ask that and judge this event very commonly in the coin of the Pentagon Papers. And I don't think it's that. And I don't think it will have the same power for a variety of different reasons. The most important difference is that the Pentagon Papers were already a synthesized narrative or story of the United States involvement in Vietnam. They were not raw data as these documents are, but a kind of secret history of the war that had been written by the government and by the military. They don't have the same power for a number of different reasons. So they're not the Pentagon Papers. But what happens is that because they're not the Pentagon Papers, that becomes an excuse for dismissing them. Another thing that happened that I didn't mention, Leo, is that those journalists and news organizations that weren't in on this arrangement tended to say, there's nothing new here.
Right.
We knew this already. I don't know what all the fuss is about. This isn't the Pentagon Papers. Or as Thomas Ricks, former and military reporter from the Washington Post said, I've learned more interesting things over dinner with a source.
So you're saying that's a little bit of sour.
On Twitter asked why he didn't reveal that.
Yeah, it's sour grapes is what you're saying, Jay.
Well, there's certainly an element of that.
The White House also said there's nothing new here. In the same breath, that they said this is a huge violation of national security.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, as you
which
point out.
Was pointed out in my post, right. And Julian Assange, who is the founder and key personality in WikiLeaks, said the same thing in several media appearances that he made.
So this show is not about this. We're not going to cover the story in the sense of here's what the WikiLeaks papers reveal. National security issues. We do have a little bit of a connection to it. Adrian Lamo, the hacker who turned in Specialist Manning for the some of the leaks, is an old friend of mine and of the show. And
Yeah,
kind of a surprise because he considers himself, I think, a white hat hacker. Did serve house arrest because he broke into the New York Times databases. But he says he did it to reveal the security problems for the Times. And as a hacker. And he says, a journalist, he spent times in chat rooms talking to different hackers. And it says that Specialist Manning confessed to him. And he felt like because of the security implications, he had to go to the Pentagon and turn the guy in. I know the hacking community is a little bit torn asunder by all of that. But even that isn't really our beat. I think our beat is really how this changes journalism. Mm. Jeff, do you have something you want to add to this before we get into the weeds?
I think there's a few things here. One is the idea of transparency, and you know the only sure fix to leaks is transparency. And I think that we're going to see, whether through practical means or whether through subversion like this, more and more the need to be transparent.
That's what Assange says WikiLeaks is all about, is transparency. That's his point.
And Daniel Ellsberg did say that he was waiting 40 years for this to happen. And if you look at a very just tactical level, the difference is, he had to stand on a Xerox machine for hours and hours. Now there's more data stored in a more accessible way that more people can get to that can be distributed more easily. And that's going to have an impact. That's the cloud. There's other clouds out there, and one is the cloud of what does the world know, and what does the government know, and what's secret and what's not.
And that's why, by the way, I feel that this is an important thing for us to discuss on this show. That's the particular area that I think is important for us.
Yes,
to discuss.
I think so. Exactly.
Yeah. I think that's exactly the
Jay focused on.
Now, I should explain for people who are listening that Jeff has a bit of a lag, and so there's going to be this little conflict where Jeff doesn't hear us talking and continues to talk. He's not being rude, and nor are we being rude to him. There's just a little lag involved. So I'm going to let you go ahead, Jeff, and then we'll I'll get Kevin and Jay back into the discussion. Go ahead, Jeff.
I'll be more sensitive to that, too. It's wacky. One thing that Jay concentrated on in his post that I think was an important point is that WikiLeaks chose to involve themselves with media organizations here. They could have just released it on their own. They chose to for various reasons. And I think the important thing about that is that journalists added value. They added value in terms of the ability to promote this. Because it was exclusive, they paid attention to it. They brought more mature judgment about what was safe and unsafe. They brought perspective. I think there's a lot of ways that we look at this and say that it's very easy now for news to be spread at a marginal cost of zero from whoever has it, whoever wants it. The journalists have to ask where they add value in that transaction. And the WikiLeaks story to me is a fascinating example of how someone came in and A, WikiLeaks saw value to be added, and B, that the news organizations really did add value.
Yeah, I thought that was the most interesting part. They released it to these three old school newspapers first to give them a chance to turn it into the Pentagon Papers, in a sense, to analyze it and to distill it. But that didn't mean that a month later they didn't release all the documents as well. They did both.
Right. Right. And what Jeff said is true. It's a very good illustration of how traditional news organizations still add value. And I think it would have had much less effect if they didn't do that. However, there's another aspect to it also, Jeff, which is that WikiLeaks discovered that if it simply puts documents that have great stories in them online, what will happen is that journalists will ignore them. And the reason that they'll ignore them is that they can't be guaranteed that if they do the work and extract the story and figure out what it is and publish it, that somebody else won't beat them to it. And so this frustration that Julian Assange had, that great stories buried in documents already online were going ignored, were being ignored by journalists, is part of what was behind his decision to give The Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel an exclusive, which is a peculiarity, a quirk, if you will, of press culture, because we tend to think that journalists will do anything for a scoop. They'll do anything for a great story. That's the thing that really motivates them. That's their bread and butter. But it's not entirely true, because there are a lot of stories still within documents that WikiLeaks has made public that are just sitting there without being reported on, because they don't fit the peculiar competitive conditions that prevail within professional journalism.
So how does this change? Does this disintermediate consumers of information? It sounds like not. It sounds like it in some ways elevates traditional media.
Yeah, I think it does. I think that's the point that Jay brought out that's really important and that WikiLeaks saw. But it doesn't happen. You know, what it said, thanks to Jay, I'm working on my book. I've been reading James Carey, who was a brilliant professor at Columbia. And as Jay explains in a preface to some of his essays, that Carey saw that there were two ways to look at journalism. And one was as a communicator of information, a transmitter of information. And that's the way journalists often see themselves, but that's not where the real value is. Mm-hmm. That the question is that in Carey's view, Jay will correct me, I'm sure, if I'm wrong, professor, because I'll get it wrong. He knows it far better than I do, but that there's a conversation going on in society and that journalism is there to reflect it and to, I would say these days, to enable it and not just to inform it. The starting point is not the journalist. The starting point is the conversation. But the journalists think they're the starting point. And so I think that what this does, they couldn't have gone to a better paper than The Guardian. Full disclosure, I write for them, but I think The Guardian is brilliant. I asked Alan Rusbridger in email, the editor of The Guardian, whether The Guardian should have started WikiLeaks. Were they jealous of this? When The Guardian saw Huffington Post, they said, crap, we should have done that. So they started Comment is Free, their version. And Alan said, no, they shouldn't have started WikiLeaks because they do different things. And there are things that The Guardian does that WikiLeaks wouldn't, and vice versa. And The Guardian and The Times and Der Spiegel are far better targets for government and companies than WikiLeaks. So what you see automatically is what you said, Leo. You see a new layer of a new kind of collaboration that occurs, and that they're dancing around each other and trying to figure out what this is.
Well, Leo, we want to get Kevin in here, but on your question about disintermediation, it is that in one sense. We have to realize that there are different kinds of leakers, and leakers have different motives. And if the aim of the leaker is to influence the discussion going on among elites, which is very often the motivation behind why people leak documents, the whole history of leaking, which would be a fascinating tale, is maybe 50% or more a result of contests for power inside institutions of government.
Yeah, most White House leaks are from people who want to assert a certain point of view within the White House conversation itself.
Right. So what you have, the dynamic, which is centuries old, what you have is internal contests for power, whether it's within Parliament, Congress, White House, or even a corporation. And the loser decides to go public by leaking key information and changing the battlefield, as it were. So if a leaker's motive is to get information out to affect a conversation going on among elites, then WikiLeaks is disintermediation, because all they care about is that other people who are tuned enough to this issue can read and find out what's going on. And it's really the other kind of leaking where you're trying to affect public opinion and public conversation that still requires, in some ways, the resources of journalism. But we should also recognize here that the balance of power is very different. Bill Keller, editor of the New York Times, in reflecting on these events, made it clear that, well, WikiLeaks was going to publish this whether we decided to join or not. In that sense, WikiLeaks was in the driver's seat as opposed to the newspaper. And they had to decide whether to play ball or not. And you know that Assange is smart enough to go to the Washington Post or the Los Angeles Times or Time Magazine if he had to. And so in that sense, even though the traditional media is still essential, they aren't in the powerful position anymore. One more thing is that the White House, which has absolutely no contacts with WikiLeaks whatsoever, had to use the New York Times as a go-between to contact WikiLeaks and urge them to at least redact important information. So now you have the New York Times, which ordinarily is the one going to the White House and saying, we have these documents and we're going to publish them because we have a source. Instead, the traditional newspaper, the New York Times, is in the position of being the negotiator or go-between between WikiLeaks and the White House, which is something completely new and novel in press relations with government.
Is this a one-time-only situation, or is this going to be the new way things are done? Is this a beginning of a trend?
Put yourself in the position of somebody who is a whistleblower and has documents that really should be public. Who would you rather deal with? A news organization that could be subpoenaed, or WikiLeaks, which has put so much effort into being completely secure
and stateless?
And stateless. And just think about the incentives and the risks for the leaker. If you think about it from the leaker's point of view, you know that this is not the last time this is going to happen.
Interesting.
Adding on to that, too, one thing I learned from the Sunday. Learning from the Sunday WikiLeaks dump is that I don't know if it's a feature they have now or if they plan to put it into the future, but people who have information, insiders of corporate companies or government can, I believe they'll now be able to go to WikiLeaks, release it to them, and then tell WikiLeaks, I want you to pass this to Der Spiegel, New York Times, the Austin American Statement, if you have a local story there. I don't know if that's something they're doing now or if that's a plan for the future, but I thought that was a really interesting change in how leaks happen. Jay was just saying, would you rather have WikiLeaks as like your unpaid attorney in getting information out, or would you rather just take your luck with whoever your local paper is?
Do any of you have any concern that there might be a backlash? I mean, I think there's a large portion of the American public who is outraged by this and believes the White House. And now I hear that 100 names have been revealed of informants in Afghanistan and believes that this leak was actually dangerous and that WikiLeaks is irresponsible. And I'm sure there was the same backlash over the Pentagon Papers, by the way. But do you think there might be a backlash against this? And in fact, a kind of return to a trust in, ironically, in the New York Times and traditional media?
Yes. I mean, I think Julian Assange, the prime mover in WikiLeaks, is in a very delicate situation with the legitimacy of his own organization. And in this particular story, if he doesn't redact the right names, if he does put people at risk, if he fails in a pledge he's sometimes made to do no harm, which I think is an important ethic for WikiLeaks to have, then the legitimacy of his organization could really be in peril. However, what's different here is that even if WikiLeaks is regarded as a dubious organization, even if people attack it and don't trust it, if it's documents we're talking about and they are authentic, it can still have a lot of power, even if people don't treat it as a legitimate news organization. And that's what's so compelling and so disruptive about it.
Julian may not care if he's considered a rogue as long as he continues to be able to do what he does.
He doesn't care about legitimacy within the frame of the nation state.
Right.
He does not care about that.
Right. Explicitly. Go ahead. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I think that and this, pardon me, a Pollyanna moment here, but if you're sitting in any organization, and let's not forget, this is not just going to be governments, it's also companies. At some point, as I said earlier on, and it's a glib line, but the only sure cure for leaks is transparency. At some point, you're going to realize that you're better off releasing more information. That the more you hold secret, the more risk you have of leaks, and anything that looks like a leak looks like an expose. Now, that's going to be a very hard lesson to get across to controlling institutions. But I think if we're looking for a long-term impact here on the culture, and I'm writing about this, obviously, so it's on the top of my brain, but I think that this default of publicness versus a default of privacy and secrecy is what we're grappling with here. And we get to a point where there is no mediator. We are all media, and we can all communicate with the world. Even if you don't go to the New York Times, you can publish something. You can put a document up, and you can say, here it is. And there are other means to be anonymous, and anonymity is always going to have its place, whether we like it or not, in crappy little comments. And so, in the end, no secret is safe. Now, some secrets should be, but here's another angle to this. There are efforts to get, obviously, every single bit of communication done in the White House to be recorded. And there are those who complain in the Bush White House and are complaining right now that certain emails are being done on private platforms. And that sounds like a flag to salute. And I would, too, that we want ultimate transparency. But there's a risk here, which is that if everything you say in writing could come out, you're going to stop saying some things in writing. And that's a danger, too. That's a risk, too. So we're trying to find a new balance to this idea of publicness and privacy in this. And I think it's going to be a very long time before we see this shake out. Over and out.
Yeah. It's just a fascinating story, and I think with big impact. And it's what we talked about on the show last week with respect to individuals, here with respect to institutions. Are there different issues for institutions, Jeff, versus for individuals? It's a choice any individual can make. Who makes the choice for the institution?
Well, I think so. I think that the individual does start with the default of privacy. My thoughts are my own. And I think that the organization has to shift to be profoundly, radically public if it wants to have trust. That anything it hides, anything that it will not make apparent and available and public, will be seen as a reason for suspicion. That's not going to be true in our private lives so much.
So it's a higher standard for institutions. It's a higher standard for institutions.
It is. I think it is in the long run. They don't see it yet, but I think that's where it'll go.
Well, and because of the fact that institutions can really impact us all, when it comes to the institution of government, for instance, there's a much higher standard for government to be transparent than there is for an individual. We demand it of government. We ought to demand it of government. And I presume that that's what's going on. This is something that's funny, that the Fourth Estate has always been charged with doing. WikiLeaks really becomes a very powerful tool now for that kind of transparency.
I think part of the challenge here,
and it's not
Leo,
just WikiLeaks.
Go ahead. We'll let Jay talk, and then I'll give you a chance, Jen.
Part of the challenge here is not just that institutions have to adjust to new rules. It's that the whole culture of professionalism in American life and in Western societies is deeply based on the control of information.
Yes.
And the control of image.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And to try and reconstruct what a professional is when information is decontrolled is really a challenge.
Yeah.
And so it's deeper than just institutional life. And what happened is that the long age of mass media, which in some ways went from 1830 to 2000, gave professionals, people inside institutions, the illusion that they could control information indefinitely. Like that was sort of the nature of of the world, right?
It's our mission, it's our portfolio.
Right. Exactly. Yes. It's our destiny, right? And it's sort of hard for them to appreciate that almost everything they know how to do is based on that, right? Mm. So what I've been trying to puzzle through is the shift in terms of authority and also in the nature of trust from a world where it's possible to control your image and to control the release of information to one where you can't do that anymore. And you simply have to be open, as Jeff says. You have to say where you're coming from. You have to say, here's the data. You have to assume that people are going to find out, you know, your secrets, right? And still try to generate trust under those conditions.
But governments will argue, and I think people are arguing now, we need some secrecy in order to operate effectively. Let's say we want to kill bin Laden. Don't we need to be able to operate in secret in some situations?
I think that is true. I think that is a good point. And in the personal space, we need some sphere of intimacy, of privacy, in order to have public selves in the first place. But even though that's true, you may still face a disruption, right, that technology is bringing about anyway. And that's why it's such a challenge to institutional dominance and professional authority. And it's far from clear how the institutions of modern life deal with this.
Yeah. So it's a challenge. This is difficult.
It's a challenge to know what to do. It's also a challenge to know how to think about it.
Yeah.
Even to what language we should use for it.
It's really, technology is so universally disruptive. We see it in business, in content creation, and now we see it in government, and it's the same answer each time. Yes, it's disruptive. Yes, we don't know exactly how to talk about it, to think about it, to deal with it. But one thing we can agree: it's happening.
Right.
Jeff, go ahead.
Here's a silly example from this week where I think that this becomes a story, as we discussed last week, about technology and change and fear. There was a Wall Street Journal story this week about Walmart putting RFID tags on pants. And
I loved your response to that.
That there were privacy wing nuts. Oh, man. I got survivalists who came to me who said, you don't want people. The fear was there was this woman in the story who thinks that, honest to God, and the Wall Street Journal quoted her as if she were a reputable source, that RFID tags are an evil plot, an anti-God plot. So what the fear was that they put forward is someone would come and scan your garbage. And so what? They find out I'm 33 now, not 32? You know, well, then what? What does that do? We don't look at the implications. But technology yields change, and change yields fright, and fright yields protection.
Right.
And that's a very small example of what Jay just said. Whether you're a big institution or whether you're a survivalist or whoever you are, there's two responses to this world coming up: to embrace the change or to try to fear it. I just read a book about the war between the Google referred to in its document back to the FTC about the war between radio and newspapers back when radio came to threaten them, and they used sacred language of saying this was a sacred cause that newspapers had, and if you disrupt it, it's bad. And now even RFID tags are a matter of somehow sacredness and the secrets the government needs. Yes, we need secrets, but first you have to have the trust to know that those who are holding secrets are holding them for a reason.
Interesting.
Very well said, Jeff.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break because we do have a limited amount of time to do this, and this conversation is a great conversation. We are going to do a government 2.0
Android.
Yeah, we're going to get to Android. Poor Kevin's left out in the cold there. But we're going to get to in just a bit. I do want to mention that we are doing a government 2.0 special, August 16th, 11 a.m., with Tim O'Reilly, Carl Malamud, and many members of government to talk about transparency issues within government, how technology is being used to promote transparency in government. And I think it is a very important conversation that's kind of an adjunct to this conversation, which is really about how the new role of journalism and of the citizen journalist and the stateless journalist, all of which very interesting. Jeff Jarvis is here as usual. Gina Trapani cannot be here. She's got a little time off sometimes, of course, but fortunately we got Kevin Purdy here.
She's on her way to supernova.
I'll just let you complete this. No, the latency is getting longer, and I apologize, Jeff. Yeah, that's where she's going, to supernova, so it's not exactly.
Gina is on her way to supernova at Philadelphia.
Excellent. And we will have her back next week. Kevin Purdy is here. You know, I'll have to do hand signals, smoke signals. We'll figure out a way. Kevin Purdy is here. He's from lifehacker.com and also the Android expert, the author of a new book, which is forthcoming, called The Complete Guide to Google Android, just as Gina's done The Complete Guide to Google Wave. Jay Rosen, an expert and a great commentator on journalism, is also with us, and professor at NYU of journalism. He's at pressthink.org. We will be back in a moment. I'll give them all a chance to grab a bite to eat or to think a little bit as I talk a little bit about our friends at Carbonite, carbonite.com. Carbonite is a backup that happens automatically without you thinking about it, not to a local hard drive. Carbonite has some advantages over the local hard drive. I don't think it's a bad idea to back up to the local hard drive. As many backups as you can make, the better, the happier I will be. But if you don't have an off-site backup, you're missing an important detail in backup. What happens if the worst happens, fire or flood, and all your data is lost because it was sitting right next to the original? Actually, just go to Carbonite.com and use the offer code Twig. Let's do that. Carbonite.com/Twig won't work. Carbonite.com and then the offer code Twig will work. And if you use that, you will get 2 weeks free to try it out. Now, here's what's going to happen. You're going to put it on your system. Carbonite will start backing up your personal data, your emails, your financial records, pictures, music, the things you hold most important, automatically to the cloud using 128-bit SSL. Here's the beauty of it, something you can't do with an external drive. You can get it back anytime on any computer. You just log on to your Carbonite account, and there's the data. They even have a free iPhone and BlackBerry app for you. Computer disasters happen. Data does get lost. Computers get misplaced. Your laptop, I'm sorry to say, hundreds of thousands of laptops are lost each year. Back it up, please. Do me a favor. Using Carbonite.com. Offer code Twig. And if you like Carbonite and decide to buy it, you can get it 2 months additional free by using Twig as the offer code when you buy. Let me put this in the lower third so you can see how to spell Twig. If you don't know how to spell Twig, now you know. Carbonite.com, offer code T-W-I-G. We use it, we recommend it, and I encourage you to do the same. Back to our conversation, Jay Rosen, Jeff Jarvis in the Poconos, and Leo Laporte. Kevin Purdy is in here also from lifehacker.com. And now we can talk a little bit about Android. I hear there's a root, a one-button root for the Droid X. Kevin, am I crazy? Should I do it right now?
Right now? I don't know. But there is a one-button root. I think a week ago it was a whole process with the terminal and all that. But it's just a root. It's not a complete firmware wipe or anything.
Well, that's what I was concerned about, because we'd heard about the eFuse. This will not trigger the eFuse on my Droid, right?
I don't believe so. I believe it's just a root that that lets you in at the level so that you can remove what everyone's complaining about the Droid X is the
junkware, the crapware, the
bloatware, crapware, whatever you want to call it.
You know, that stuff doesn't bother me. You can't uninstall a lot of the Motorola apps. Same thing on an HTC with the Sense or the Samsung, which has a lot of crapware on it. But that's just icons.
I'm always amazed that the Sense phones don't let you at least go back to Google stock. That's a major complaint of mine.
Well, I have that too. For instance, it's not using the Google SMS on the Droid X. So there are a few things. I wish I could use the Google stock applications. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Droid X, I think, has enough memory where it's not a big issue.
8 gigabytes of app memory. So there's plenty of room in here.
There you go. Yeah. But I mean, some people really don't like the feel of scrolling through their app tray and seeing things they can't remove. So especially Android users. I mean, I don't want to I don't want to typecast, but people who like to feel like they've got an open phone, a phone they control, you know, a phone they can set up a portable hotspot with, they don't like seeing, you know, even though it seems like a really cool game, Need for Speed on their phone, and they can't pull it off or whatnot.
So this eFuse story, I think, is a little overblown.
I don't own a Droid X, so, you know, your mileage may vary, but I believe that there is now currently a route that that just gets in and gives you the access and doesn't change firmware or do anything else that would trigger what you call a boot back to the rescue, the whatever you call it. I'm sorry.
They go into rescue mode and then you have to put a new firmware on it. They say
the bootloader,
right?
Yeah,
the bootloader. So Apple decided that they were maybe a little threatened. I don't know, by the Droid X. So they put out a video, which has since disappeared, I believe, showing the Droid X antenna.
Yes, and the BlackBerry and the I believe the HTC Incredible too, showing that if you hold it, I believe Google phones, it's the bottom of the phone. Right. Like, this would be a kind of death grip on most HTC or
Have
Motorola.
Have you been able to get it to happen?
I'm on T-Mobile, so I don't know what would be amazing service drop down to mediocre. I like T-Mobile, actually. In Buffalo, it's fine. I hear it's not too good, you know, New York or LA or whatever, but.
I can't get it to happen on Verizon, period.
No, I've never been able to replicate it, but I wasn't looking for it like a lot of iPhone owners would be. iPhone owners are much more aware of their service, it seems.
Right. How about the Poconos, Jeff? Is it working up there?
My AT&T is actually working very well here. You know, the AT&T, the Apple response with those videos seems to me rather childish rhetoric of, but Joey started it.
Yeah, I know I am, but what are you?
Right, it doesn't really fix the problem.
Right.
I like how someone pointed out that now attenuation has become a common word. That, like, it's spread from, like, you know, wireless engineers to the general public. Like, oh, does your phone have attenuation?
Well, I know I can see that you're detuning your antenna when you hold the phone like that. That's just not appropriate. Good news for Nexus One owners. We thought that the Nexus One was dead. It looks now like the HTC folks are just going to take the AMOLED screen out of it because they're in short supply and use Super LCD in it and the Incredible, and still offer those phones for sale somewhere. Google's not going to sell them. I don't know where.
T-Mobile stores are supposed to get Nexus Ones. Jeff,
T-Mobile's not going to.
Say again.
T-Mobile just said if we look up that they're not going to sell it.
Oh.
So
that's sad because I think this is actually a really great Google phone experience with 2.2. It's even with the Super LCD screen, which is actually still a pretty good screen.
Some people were saying that, like, the Android stock experience, the Nexus One, what it really does, I believe it was on Daring Fireball too, is that what it does is it shows you what a phone is like without carrier or manufacturer intervention.
And you need
like,
that.
It shows you what your phone could be like if they didn't want to have you using AOL, IM, or you know, whatever else they jam on your phone.
Not the Incredible, the Desire. Thank you for the correction, Mastermind. I meant the Desire.
Ah.
Yes. Changing Google Voice directs access numbers for speedier dialing, which eliminates, unfortunately, the free calling trick people have been able to use. So if you're on Android or BlackBerry, there's an update that allows direct access number. In other words, assigns a unique outgoing call number to everybody you dial.
Which is really great for people who don't have a great data connection, maybe at home or wherever they are, because previously a Google Voice app would reach out to the server, contact it, let it know that you're trying to call this other number, retrieve the number roughly, and then
funky.
Deliver it to your phone.
It's funky.
Yeah, and it was 5 or 6 seconds. It's embarrassing to pull out your phone and be like, I'm gonna call and order a pizza.
It calls you back.
Yeah, right.
It's so
and then
weird.
It basically calls you back. But now I believe it stores the unique numbers that Google Voice generates for every one of your contacts in your phone. So it's pretty instant now. It's just like calling on a regular, you know, regular connection.
Unfortunately, it'll cost you minutes now.
Yeah, the old trick that you're referring to is the one where the plans where you have, you know, your five friends that you can call forever. You just assign your Google Voice number as one of those friends and then, unlimited calls.
Right.
I think carriers were kind of pushing away from those, have been pushing away from those, you know, circle of friends plans anyways.
Yeah, I didn't use it because who wanted to sit there while you make a call and wait for Google Voice to call you back? It just was a pain in the butt.
It's pretty fast now on the Nexus One, even on T-Mobile.
Yeah. Yahoo Japan has chosen Google for its search engine, which is kind of bizarre. Yahoo in the U.S. uses Microsoft. The pause you're hearing.
I think it was a slap to both Microsoft and Yahoo U.S.
Yeah, they slapped everybody all around. Yahoo Japan is a different owner, at least majority owner, I guess. We'll just cut the pauses out.
Yeah, I know. We'll just... I feel so stupid.
Yeah. Jay, if you have anything to add to this, please do. But don't feel like you have to stick around either if you're not at all interested in anything we're talking about here.
You wouldn't believe how backward my phone is.
What do you use?
Jay is pathetic.
I actually have. I'm not joking. I have an AARP phone has absolutely no internet access at all. And the only reason I have it is in case my daughter, you know, has a problem at school or something like that. And I'm not even mobile.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah,
you teach Columbia, Jay. Sorry, couldn't resist.
You know? Right, it's my curmudgeon self coming out.
I want to ask Kevin about the two things. One is that Lionel Menchaca at Dell said that they've gotten more pre-release interest in their 5-inch Android device, whose name I'm suddenly forgetting,
the streak.
Than any time before.
The streak,
and then there's
yeah.
this weird, right, streak. And then there's this weird thing about the Augen, the $150 Android tablet that is now in the Kmart circular and appears to be real. How could it be at $150?
Well, not only, it's in the circular, but it's apparently not in the stores because everybody who's tweeted me has said, I don't see any. I'm looking for them. They're sold out. Have you, has anybody seen one?
No, I haven't. I mean, what is it? Engadget said that they didn't have, they called one and they said, no, we don't, you know, we don't have it in stock and couldn't give any information. But Android 2.1 and 2 gigs of storage and I don't remember how much memory, but it was, I can't even do the math of how that's $150.
It's got to be something horrible in there. I mean, it can't be. It's got to be an Atom processor or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's shots of it. I mean, that doesn't prove anything these days, but it seems interesting. I just got to wonder about how Kmart is going to be the avatar of Android marketing for a tablet. How Kmart or, you know, any other similar non-electronic store is going to be the one to push an Android tablet and get it and get customers to know it and want it, I guess.
Well, but Dell, on the other hand, absolutely
could.
Well,
that is interesting. Sorry. I think somebody like Walmart could be the one to make Android go ballistic. Over.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, they for a while, Walmart was selling a $150 Linux-based computer that was based on GOS, which was actually just a Google-obsessed Linux operating system. And I think they sold some, but I believe they eventually kind of canceled the project. But I would be really interested to see... you know, kind of mass market stores pushing an Android tablet and totally you know, putting it in the market as the cheaper non-iPad, I guess. I haven't played with any of them, though, so I can't tell you how they work.
The Dell Streak is a 5-inch tablet. I think they're under $500, Kevin, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, roughly, something like that.
And so a lot of pre-orders.
It would be a direct competitor to the iPad.
Yeah, and a lot of interest in that. I'll order one and get one in house as soon as I can.
I would love to. I'd love to.
Is it AT&T that. Only?
I think so.
Yes.
It's kind of too bad. How does AT&T get this?
I have no idea.
Can I take my iPhone SIM out and put it in the Dell device?
I don't know. You couldn't do that. You could only do that with scissors for the iPad.
Because it's a micro SIM. It was a micro SIM
In the iPad.
But yeah. I would presume the Streak is a micro SIM. It's only. I mean, everybody's moving to micro SIM. It is. The Streak is unlocked. Although I guess they sell two flavors: locked and unlocked. Right?
Yeah, I believe so. From what I've read,
I'd have to think AT&T is doing something with the SIM in a 3G iPad to keep you from doing exactly that. I can't imagine that they're not checking something.
But why, at some point, why is it there? It's not, it's, I don't see whether it's against, how it's against AT&T's interests to have you use the same account on multiple devices if you could only use one at a time.
I'll tell you why. It's against AT&T's interest to piss off Apple in any possible way, because the Apple is so anxious to get rid of AT&T that if I were AT&T, I'd be groveling. I'd be on the floor. I'd be crawling to Steve saying, can I shine your shoes? Can I get you anything, Mr. Jobs? Is everything okay? So they're not going to do, I mean, they're going to be very careful, I think, to protect Apple's business interests.
According to that Wired story, they could do all that and it still wouldn't matter. The Wired story from 2 weeks ago detailing the relationship between Google and
wasn't that something?
Excuse me, between Apple and AT&T.
Wasn't that something? That was amazing. To see behind the curtain there and to see what was going on. And Steve Jobs saying, I'm going to call AT&T and yell at them. These guys are dead. I mean, it was amazing to see this. And talk about a shift in balance of power. There is a big shift from the cell companies, which really have dominated this market and dominated the handset manufacturers. And here comes Apple and just becomes totally the boss of that relationship.
AT&T, the former ruler of all telecommunication in the United States, now has to,
groveling to hippies. These hippies at Apple. Jeff bookmarked an interesting story, a quote from Eric Schmidt. Google, of course, supposedly creating a Facebook social network. Everybody has confirmed it. Kevin Rose gave it the name Google Me. Adam D'Angelo said, yeah, absolutely. He's the guy at Quora said. But now the Journal, even the Journal says that the Google is trying to do something. They acquired Playdom, or social gaming network, invested $100 million in Zynga. Somebody better tell Eric Schmidt, though, because Eric said the world doesn't need, quote, a copy of the same thing. He says Facebook is good for Google because Facebook users use more Google products than other users. He said, we have an announcement. You can't expect a partnership with Zynga. But he says, that we're not doing a Facebook clone. Disinformation from Eric Schmidt?
Yeah, I don't think that they... if Eric's wrong, then count the days to his departure. I can't imagine that he is. It would not make any sense to try to be Facebook against Facebook. Google's too smart for that. They're going to look for that unique thing. I think that there's some criminology to be read in the fact that Rick Clow won't come on our show yet because he's working on profiles, and I think there's big stuff coming up with profiles and big different opportunities with Google, and we'll see where that goes. But I don't think it's going to be a clone. I think he's right.
Well, that makes sense. So it's really parsing his sentence. Yes, we're going to do a Facebook thing, but it's not going to be a clone. It'll be green.
Right. Even look at the fact that Amazon this week, in a deal I don't fully understand, or in a move I don't fully understand, they're going to use your Facebook friends in terms of purchases.
Yeah.
And so Facebook becomes a given. And the question for, just like Zynga is a given in games now, Google is a given in the world. Could they become the next Alta Vista and be destroyed? Yes, anybody could. But I think if you look at a world of givens and say, all right, what the smart thing to do is to figure out how do you deal with this thing that we can't get rid of, that it's just there. And so Facebook is a thing you can't get rid of. It's there. And Google will find clever ways, I think, to work with them. And the thing to read into what Schmidt said was that they sell to different advertisers, they sell different advertising opportunities, and that Facebook is good for Google because Google believes that everybody who uses the internet is good for Google.
For a moment, I thought you said a world of gibbons, as in monkeys. And from my point of view, there is something about Facebook that reminds me of a world of gibbons. Here's an interesting security and privacy story. According to Thing, 100 million Facebook user pages were scraped by a fellow from Skull Security and placed on BitTorrent. None of this is illegal. Ron,
it was the, uh, It was the entire directory of everybody who has not changed their settings or have intentionally made themselves public, but they probably did not presume that they would be combined into a 2.8 gigabit file that becomes a stalker's favorite toy.
Yeah. I mean, not just names and URLs, but some of this stuff has phone numbers, depending on whether people were paying attention when they looked at the privacy settings. Or maybe there are people like Jeff who just like to, you know, put their pants out in public. But it does raise a very interesting point. 100 million out of the 500 million Facebook users apparently don't care if their stuff's public, and now it's available for anybody who wants to download from a BitTorrent site.
But at some level, you want to be in control of this, all true. But at some level, you know what? Let me break something to you. Do you know the phone book used to put out whole thing with all your addresses and phone numbers in it?
That's true. On the other hand, you couldn't really download it as a 2.8 gigabyte BitTorrent file, but...
No, it was better. It was paper. We love paper. Paper's right there. It's on your shelf.
Yeah.
It's hard to do jokes with this lag.
Timing is everything.
What about this proof of concept? You know, actually, I really like the new Google Maps. So Google Maps got a big update this week, at least on Android. I don't know if it also got updated on iPhone. I think it did not. But
it was just an Android
thing. So they added... I haven't even counted them all, but I think four new icons in my...
There are four now total. When you first Android, it was just maps. And I guess just user interface decisions, it's now broken off into... There's the maps, and then there's the latitude has its own separate icon. Navigation has its own separate icon. And the one they just added was places, which is a... you know, what's near me right now, you know, instead of having to go to the map, have it figure out where you are, this one can do restaurants, coffee, bars, hotels, attractions, ATMs. So it's
Yelpish. And in fact, it includes Yelp reviews in here.
Yeah. And the same kind of aggregation that Google does with maps that shows you all the reviews that they could scrape. And then, you know, even color coded to show you that this place is generally getting 4 stars, 5 stars,
right,
and that type of thing.
I actually like it, but this isn't anything different that you could already get in maps. It's just it's got its own call out. Is that the...
Yeah, just now you don't have to go search for a place or click on a street near you and find this. Now you can just directly have your GPS unit tell you what's nearby. But what in another story in the Fred feed, what people were wondering was, well, Google's doing this. Google's taking one application and letting it split out into four different icons. I wonder if other applications can do it. And so someone came up with a proof of concept app. I think it was just called like App Launcher Spam or something. And he managed to put 20 different icons on his phone. If you install this application, whose only purpose is to do this, it would just...
Spam expands your app drawer. Now, uninstalling it removes it, but it is definitely a proof of concept, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and it relates to the general issue with the Android market, and the other big market issue this week was the Google removing, I believe, 3,000 applications, but 3,000 from three particular developers, and 6,000 spam apps. I'm sorry.
Wow.
From three different developers who were mostly doing the kind of wallpaper ringtone stuff that you hate to see in there when you're just looking for something real, full of copyright violations, full of, you know, just junk. And Google, you know, removed them unilaterally. And there's one of the developers contracted the Android guy's blog, and the quote on the headline was, "We will flood the Android market." And he revealed in broken English that he owned three or four other development names and that he has more than 1,000 apps still on the market. So it's a great problem to have an open market and deal with guys who want to do nothing but put out Usher ringtones and Twilight wallpapers and et al. Into infinity.
I'm glad. I actually am glad though that Google's doing something about it. They also extended the refund time frame. This is something the Apple Store does not have, and I think is a really good feature. You have 24 hours. If you buy an app, and then, by the way, most of the apps on the Android Store are free, but if you buy an app on the Android Store, you had 24 hours to uninstall it, and automatically you'd get a refund. Now you have 48 hours. And in most cases, if you buy it from the apps, the marketplace anyway, you get a refund automatically. You don't have to do anything, which means that you can try any paid application for 2 days. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, Kevin, I feel like I'm in school. Teacher, can I talk now? I talk about on the show occasionally saying that I think one problem for Android is that it is hard to find the good apps, and it's going to be like the whole Googleverse, that there's spam everywhere and there's junk in there. What do you think about the quality of the Android marketplace, and what do you think Google is doing, can do, and should do about quality?
Well, the savvy folks who the Android power users, the Android geeks, usually we're going to go to a place like AppBrain, which you guys
love
have talked
it.
About on the show
love
here
it,
before.
Love it, yeah, love
AppBrain,
it.
Some of the other third-party search engines, whose names escape me right now, but that have decent ranking listing, and most of the apps that are recommended on those sites are by real Android users that like good stuff. I am able to find the apps that I need or apps that are cool, but I have an unfair advantage in that I wake up every morning and read RSS feeds for Lifehacker.
Right.
So I'm reading like 10 Android blogs every morning, and you can find great apps that way because they're doing all the curating. I think it's a pretty big problem for Google, and I like to see them taking steps like this, like wiping out the obvious install bait, I guess is the word now. But I also wonder, when they're going to have their Apple moment and overstep, when they're going to, when they're going to start removing things that shouldn't be removed. And it hasn't happened yet because the market is still very flush.
Do you have a favorite? Is AppBrain your favorite? There's AndroLib is another one. There's a number of different choices.
AppBrain, because of that fast web install feature they have.
Love that. If you don't have Froyo yet, this is the best way.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. But when everyone gets up to Froyo, including those Verizon users who rumored to get it in mid-August, AppBrain has a fast web installer that is awesome. And you install the AppBrain application and fast web, and whenever you're on the AppBrain website, you can just click, and all of a sudden you look on your phone and it's downloading.
Yeah.
And that's the future.
There's also Android now has an automatic update in 2.2 has an automatic update feature. You could check a box that says, look, I love this app. Whenever it's updated, just make sure you get the latest version. And that just does it automatically. That is a great feature.
And it is, unless the app has some quirks to it.
If the app is crap, don't turn that on. Yeah.
Oh, no. The Google Voice application. Every time you update Google Voice, you need to run it again. You need to relaunch it because otherwise it won't connect. And it'll sound like the dog ate my homework, but my boss at Lifehacker texted me the other day, and Google Voice had automatically updated it, and it hadn't relaunched. And so I missed a text about an article and its whereabouts.
I guess you want to make sure you restart Google Voice a lot.
Or just either the apps that are very sensitive to you, maybe don't have them automatically update.
Right.
Either.
Or don't exclude them from a task killer if you use a task killer and then kill. I kill tasks at least once a day. So
indeed,
that probably is another good way to do it. Jeff, Leo? You had your... Yes, go ahead, Jay.
To go back to something Kevin said earlier, we might adapt Clay Shirky's maxim and say there's no such thing as too many apps. There's only filter failure.
I think you're exactly right.
And another point I wanted to add before I have to go is that just as he said, Kevin said that I wake up for Lifehacker every morning and I read all these RSS feeds, and so I have this advantage. I think that's one illustration of the simplest way for journalists to add value today. It's saving the user time. And any time that you use your time to save the user's time, or any technology that does that, or any journalistic routine that's able to accomplish that, is creating value. Because that's one of the most common and most solid ways of becoming a useful journalist is simply to save the user time. And if more young journalists thought about that, instead of getting stories or adding to the flood or simply recycling old forms, they thought about new and unique ways of saving users' time, they would be on the right road to adding value as a journalist.
Jay, absolutely.
Inspiration. Jay Rosen, I want to let you go. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Pressthink.org. Would love to have you back. Thanks for your very astute, I think, points about WikiLeaks. And there's a great blog post that you've got there. And I'm sure more to come.
Our pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Bye. Jay. Take care. Jay Rosen. We're going to actually take a break. It'd be a good time to take a little break and talk about Ford and Ford Sync, because we're going to Detroit tomorrow. I'm flying out to Detroit, and I'll talk about that in just a second. We will continue on, though, with our picks of the week and our number of the week. And I guess because you're filling in for Gina, you're going to have to do a, Kevin, you're going to have to do a
tip of the week.
Are you ready? Are you prepared?
Think
about it. I'll give you time.
Okay.
You've got the entire resources of Lifehacker at your disposal, Kevin.
That is true. But it'll probably be Android related.
I would love an Android tip. I really would, as a devout Android user.
Okay.
One of the things I actually want to mention is that, you know, some people complain about the hands-free on Android. There is a hands-free application, but not all the Bluetooth devices work hands-free, truly hands-free. Ford Sync does. It is a great match for iPhone. I use all the kinds of phones with it, but a really great match for Android as well, because when you get in the car and you pair your Android device or your iPhone device with Sync, it downloads the address book. And from now on, when somebody calls, they call and they're announced by name. And when you call them, you can call them by name. That's what Ford means by true hands-free calling. You never take your hands off the wheel. You just press the button that says, "Hello, Sync, I want to talk to you." You keep your eyes on the road. You're safe, but you can say, "Call Kevin Purdy on cell," and even on Android, it will dial the number and make the call for you. It'll play songs from. I knew that it would do it via Bluetooth using A2DP over most Android devices. I wanted to see if the USB interface worked. It did. So it'll also index all the songs, and they'll show up. And you can call for songs by name on your Ford Sync. You get turn-by-turn voice directions. I know you Android folks don't care much about that, but because of A2DP, those voice directions will come through the stereo system of your car if you're using Android. And if you're not, Sync also has its own turn-by-turn directions. You can have a race to see who's better. Voice-activated podcast browsing, text messages on some phones are read aloud. I'm going to give you a little secret. I use a Blue Ant T1. And it has an Android application that's written just for the T1 to read text messages to the T1. Well, it also works with the Ford Sync. So now it's kind of funny to hear the automated voices when people text me. It goes, my Ford Sync goes, beep, I've got a text for you. Press the Sync button, say, read me the message. And it reads you the message. It even gives you a choice of pre-canned responses you can send back. I love that. Personalized traffic alerts, weather, and so much more. All this while keeping your eyes on the road, your hands on the wheel. You can focus on what you're doing and where you're going. That's important for safety. It even has things like 911 assist, so it'll automatically call 911 if the airbags are deployed. Learn more about it at SyncMyRidePodcast.com or go to your Ford, Lincoln, or Mercury dealer and take a look at Ford Sync. In the new 2011s, it's even updated. I just drove a 2011 Fiesta, and the Sync is getting better and better all the time. Now, we're going to be visiting the Maker Faire, thanks to Ford. Ford's all about innovation. Their new technologies like Sync, the new EcoBoost engine. I don't know if you've heard about that, but that's amazing. So Ford is also supporting Maker Faire. They love makers. They're bringing the Maker Faire to the Henry Ford Museum in Detroit. I'm going to be going. There'll be 300 inventors, creators, builders, and innovators all there. I'm flying to Detroit tomorrow. We'll be in Detroit Friday, July 30th. We are getting an exclusive tour of the assembly line and some of the high-tech devices Ford uses to design cars. I'm very excited about this. We'll begin that at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. We have our live U unit, so we're going to be able to stream this live. And I'm hoping, we'll see, if we're going to get to take the live U on the test track and get driven around by their most accomplished test driver. I don't know what that's going to be like, but I can't wait. That's on Friday, and then on Saturday, we're at same time, 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to be bringing you live coverage from the Maker Faire, and I'm very excited to meet these engineers, designers, craftspeople. We're going to start earlier on Friday. We're starting at 7 a.m. Pacific, 10 a.m. Eastern. Thank you, Lisa, our producer, Lisa Kensel, who is also our CEO, has got the schedule on that. So this is very exciting. Make sure you check it out Friday, July 30th and Saturday, July 31st, starting early in the morning Pacific time, mid-morning East Coast time for our coverage from Detroit. And do go to a Ford dealer, Lincoln Mercury dealer, and check out the great Ford Sync. Now, Mr. Kevin Purdy, I have given you as much time as you're going to get to come up with a fantastic Android tip that's just going to blow us out of the water. Are you ready, sir?
I believe I am. It's not even my tip to Lifehacker, but one of the cool things about Android 2.1 and 2.2, I believe, is that it has a voice to text feature, and you can use that to pretty much search anywhere on the phone and enter text anywhere on the phone. So if you're writing an email in your car, and you shouldn't be, but you can actually write the email with your voice in, you know, little sentence bursts or whatnot. One of our readers on Lifehacker actually wrote in and suggested that it's a really great way to do calculations and conversions without having to, you know, if you're cooking or if you're just want to, you know, quickly convert, you know, quarts to cups or anything like that. You can just one thing also Android users don't know is that you can usually just hold down the search button to bring up the voice prompt.
Yeah, after a couple of seconds, it comes up.
After a couple of seconds, it comes up. Not everybody knows that, though. Everyone thinks it's only in the search.
8 liters. Now what's going to happen? Is it going to convert 8 liters?
Well, you just said 8 liters, so I don't know what it's going to get. It's probably just going to tell you about, it's going to search for a band in Australia named 8 liters.
Oh, 8 liters. I love them.
They were a great.
What should I have said? What would be better to say?
So try something like 32 degrees Fahrenheit to Celsius.
Okay. Let me try that. Okay. So it did, by the way, look up 8 liters and how many gallons is 8 liters on Yahoo. So I now know that a jug, let's see, one drink from 8 to 10, there's a lot of 8 liters. let me do the one that you suggest. So what should I say?
Say try something like 32 degrees Fahrenheit to Celsius.
Do I have to say the word convert?
I don't believe so.
Look at that.
Boom.
Boom.
Well, 30,
I did 332. I maybe said an extra three. Is 166 degrees Celsius.
I think I interrupted you while you were saying.
Let me try it again. Right, I'll try it again. 42 degrees Celsius to Fahrenheit. This is like the Star Trek. This is fantastic. Working. Why? That is.
Oh, no.
I don't know what it says. Wait a minute. Oh, you know what? It looked up E-Trade for me. I don't know.
Oh, good, good. Well,
you know what? It's because I'm talking while I'm doing this.
There's a video on Lifehacker. Android's voice activated search is an awesome calculator and conversion tool. And one of our commenters actually has a video up that of him doing these, you know, kind of very cool calculations and conversions. I thought that was a pretty neat tip to come up with during a Ford Sync commercial.
You did good. No, I love that. I think that's a double tip because holding down that search button, I just recently learned about that. And I think that that's one of the things about Android that I just love is that dictation is everywhere. It's pretty good quality. And you can dictate text messages, emails, and so forth. And it's really great. I just think this is one of the best features of Android.
Plus, it gives everyone a chance to try on their radio voice. Their highly enunciated versions.
I am going to speak clear. Well, as you can see, it doesn't work for me. No. A great tip. Thank you, Kevin Purdy. Kevin's book, by the way, is coming. It's The Complete Guide to Google Android.
Just
not Google. You leave the, because I guess it isn't just Google. It's the Open Handset Alliance.
It's The Complete Guide to Android. We're about 30 days-ish from official launch. What I wanted to tell folks on Twig today was that we have a Twitter account, twitter.com/CompleteAndroid, or just, you know, follow Complete Android. And during the run-up to the book, we're going to be doing something around five Android tips a day. So we're not just going to be, you know, pimping the book. We're going to be grabbing tips from the book
and
from our own brains, pushing out five or so tips a day. And when the book is available for presale, we will be offering anyone who's following us on Twitter and our Facebook fans 25% off the book when it finally launches. And
through the Twitter account.
Yes, if you, I don't know the mechanics of it right now, but I believe that followers of Complete Android will get 25% off the book when it launches.
Well, I'm following you now.
And like Gina's book, The Complete Guide to Google Wave, there will be, the book itself will be online, but we'll also have a PDF version and a print version at some point. We're going to launch in roughly a month or so. It's been fun to to write up all the little tiny little things about Android that people do and don't know. It is, like Jeff said, sometimes a operating system of Easter eggs, but it's a good one. I think I tackled a lot of people's first out of the box questions when they get their phone, like, how do I do this? How do I set up this?
I think that's good because I'm meeting a lot of people these days who are buying their first smartphone, not just first Android phone, but their first smartphone. Mm-hmm. I met somebody when I was in line at the Droid X, and she was buying this, and her son was buying this. He was going to college, they wanted both to have it. She said, "What? Give me some tips." And I thought, "Well, that's a lot I could tell you."
Where do I start?
I mentioned AppBrain was my fundamental tip, but there are a whole lot of them. I can't wait to get this book. I'm really looking forward to it.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that we also have a Cafe Press store up with these cute little shirts and coffee mugs and bags and such that it says, "I complete me," by the way. It's at cafepress.com/complete guides.
All right, great. Time for our number of the week. I'm going to say this slowly to give Jeff Jarvis time to hear me.
I'm going to say it is 1 billion, one of my favorite numbers. Eric Schmidt said to the Wall Street Journal, according to Fortune, that Google will someday in the near future make, $10 billion just for mobile. And wow. Fortune found this amazing, but Schmidt said, "Well, if I made only $10 from every user and we had a billion phones, there you are." So Fortune said, "Well, how do you get to 10 billion phones? They're selling 160,000 a day now, and that would take 17 years to get to a billion. But, you know, cut that in, quadruple that, which is not a crazy rate of sale to imagine for Android going across many countries and many kinds of devices. And in 4 years, you're there with a billion phones, a billion Android phones. And then Kevin, by the way, is a very rich and valuable man."
You're not kidding. And Gina's going, "Why did I write a book about Wave? Why Wave? Why me?" No. Shh. Wave, I'm sure it's just going to take off any minute now. So, you know what? I'm gonna take off my tip on your tip. And I actually had planned this a while ago. But it's from a Lifehacker article, so I guess you get credit anyway for it, Kevin Purdy. It's that not only can you do conversions of measurements, you can also, and this is something I use all the time on Google, you can get time zone information, because I'm always trying to figure out what the hell time is at UTC. Well, here's my dirty little secret, and now I'm going to use the dictation. I'm going to press the button, time in London, and see if this works. I'm shouting at my phone. Maybe I should get that AARP phone. Buzzed. I don't know where it got buzz time in London. Let me try that again. Time in London. Forget the buzz part. There it is. It's 10:33 p.m. in London, BST. London, Ontario, it's 5:33 p.m., and in London, Arkansas, it's 4:33 p.m. All thanks to the magic of the Google. You don't have to have a Google phone to do that. It works on your Google page. And I do, you know, when you see me saying, "What time is that UTC?" I do that search on the Google. Thank you, Kevin Purdy, for being here. Really great to have you. I look forward to the book. Kevin Purdy, of course, writes for Lifehacker. And his new book, The Complete Guide to Android, will be out soon. Follow him on Twitter to get a discount. Twitter.com/complete Android.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. Jeff Jarvis is the man who wrote the book, not the Complete Guide to Google, but What Would Google Do? Although you could have called it The Complete Guide to Google. His next book is going to be called Public Parts. He's at buzzmachine.com. That's where he blogs. And he is right now in the Poconos, where, as a matter of fact, if you ask what time it is, it's about 4 seconds later than it is here. Thank you, Jeff. It's great to see you. We'll see you all next week. Gino will be back with us on This Week in Google. Take care.